Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
As the calendar turns each year, organizations, both large and small, offer their assessments of what to expect in the year ahead. Indeed, we at Teneo do so ourselves, as those of you who heard our Teneo Insights calls toward the end of the year and read our research all well know. The Economist, the celebrated British weekly news magazine or newspaper, as they still like to call it, does so as well. And the world ahead, 2022, this is it, is their version of that. And it stands out for really a few reasons. First, it arrives very early. It comes out in November, actually. And secondly, it's extremely comprehensive, covering everything from politics to business, as you would expect, but also science and technology, culture, and even fashion. And beyond making predictions, it offers robust analysis of the significance of these issues, how they're going to impact our lives, the markets, and the cultural zeitgeist. And they've got significant contributors as varied as in this year's edition, the president of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa, major political thinkers like Francis Fukuyama, and even the dissident artist Ai Weiwei. And it's multimedia. And recently, supported by Teneo, The Economist released its accompanying docuseries, What Does the Future Hold for 2022, along with five accompanying film shorts. And it's available on Teneo's website. There was a link to it in the invitation to today's call. And of course, it's also available on The Economist website. So joining me today is the man who makes all of this possible, Tom Standage. He's the editor of The World Ahead, and he's the deputy editor of The Economist itself, and he's the head of its digital strategy. He's been there since 1998, following stints at both The Guardian and The Daily Telegraph, so showing some range there. And he's the author of six books, including Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years. So, Tom, welcome, and thank you for joining me today. And, you know, before we jump into the substance of this year's edition, I'm interested somewhat in how you put all of this together. It's a daunting task. I know because of the comprehensive nature of it, you and your colleagues have got to start early. So how do you plot it all out? How do you red team it? You know, how do you get this thing ready for November?
That's a very good question. I should say thank you very much. Great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. Yes, we actually start each year's edition in May. We start putting it together in May, and we have what used to be a big gathering in the office in person, and it was we'd have a tea. It was always on a Monday afternoon, and we would have enormous supplies of sort of pastries and lots of pots of tea and coffee, and essentially there would be a massive sugar rush, and this would get all of my colleagues to come up with, you know, what they thought would be the themes. At that point, obviously, it's a very preliminary take on it, but that's the first sort of, you know, attempt to get them to talk about the themes for the year ahead. And the good thing about that meeting was always that we would have, you know, a good representation from across the staff, lots of different topics. And so people would give each other ideas, and they would spot connections, and they would spot patterns, and it would be a good way of doing things. And we've tried to, you know, keep that sort of level of dynamism when we do this on Zoom, but it's a lot more difficult, and that we don't have the quantity of, you know, sugar flowing through our systems. Anyway, so the other thing we do at that meeting is we start to try and identify the interesting people that we think we either need to write about or invite to write for us, because this annual is put together with a combination of articles by my colleagues on the editorial staff from around the world, but also we have guest pieces. And we are trying to figure out, you know, who is doing interesting things in this part of the world or in this industry or whatever. Who should we hear from? Who's an up and coming star? You know, who's going to be the name that everyone will have heard of in 10 years time that we could get to write for us now? And then, you know, who are big names who've got interesting thoughts on some of the themes that we've identified for the coming year? So we come up with essentially a sort of first stab at the list of contents towards the end of June. And then after that, it's sort of iteration. The copy is not actually due. The copy comes in during September in sort of four waves, one each week. And we accept that, you know, news and people's changing opinions about what's important for the coming year is going to change, you know, up until that point, and in fact, after that point. But we have to start somewhere. So it's a very kind of constantly evolving table of contents. And in fact, I send out several iterations of it to the entire staff to say, look, this is the latest version. This is what we've added. This is what we've taken out. This is who's confirmed as a guest writer and so forth and so forth. And essentially, we then get to the point where by the end of October, it's laid out, it's edited. We could, actually it's about the middle of October, we could plausibly print it then. And then we have this sort of 2-week period while we're fact checking everything and proofreading everything and also adjusting for news. Oh, we really need one more page in the Middle East section on this, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Or we could do with one more contributor on this topic from the outside. And then it all goes to press right at the beginning of November. This is obviously a total nightmare in years where you've got a US election. You know, the year before, we had this, we actually extended the print deadline because the outcome of the 2020 election was not immediately clear whether Biden would prevail. It's quite a white knuckle ride in those last few weeks in October. But yes, it does start relatively early, and I'm about to start. I've already got my preliminary list of 2023 things, and it's starting to sort of get more substantial towards as we go towards May.
And aside from the fact that you had to meet with your colleagues over Zoom rather than in person, was there anything else that was particularly challenging that 2022 posed to you and your group versus other years?
I don't think so. I mean, obviously, we figured out how to do all of the practical stuff remotely. And I think the situation, one of the things I have to do is write an article each year looking at how we did the previous year and sort of what we got right and what we got wrong. Obviously, we had a terrible year with our predictions for 2020 because we did not predict that the pandemic would happen. And we got a lot of things right up until the point that the pandemic hit. You know, we made good guesses on the who the new leader of the Labour Party would be in Britain, who would win the election in Taiwan, you know, this kind of stuff. And we were very bullish on people doing more stuff online. And, you know, we've been talking about the metaverse for a while. And so we said that was something that, you know, would happen in 2020. And of course, it happened in a way that we didn't expect because the pandemic hit. We had a much better year in 2021, paradoxically, because the pandemic, you know, we knew that was going to be the biggest story or a very big story in many countries and many industries. And that sort of, you know, narrowed the range of possibilities. We were worried about post-election violence in America, and we were right on that score. And it's broadly the same with 2022. We know that this is a sort of pandemic. We think it's receding, and I think that's still fair. But we know it's very much, you know, still with us. But I think there is more of a sense that things other than the pandemic are reasserting themselves now. It's not, you know, it's not always the main story on the news anymore, and it hasn't been for quite a while. It's still there rumbling away in the background, and you do get these flare-ups like with Omicron, where people suddenly get much more worried about it and pay more attention. But things like climate change, things like the state of democracy in America, things like the rise of China, those sorts of big long-term stories are, I think, reasserting themselves, and we're getting used to the pandemic in many ways, including the way that it's no longer sort of always the top item on the news.
And one last question just on this process before we get into the substance here. You know, you've obviously got literally, you know, well over 100 articles in the edition. You yourself distill it down to 10 major themes at the beginning. And then, you know, for the film series, you distill it down to 5. How do you get to that, which doesn't necessarily right. link up exactly with your top 10 list? What's the process there?
So with the top 10, the editor's letter that I write at the beginning, basically I've spent my, you know, the past few months thinking about these themes. And so I'm spotting the connections and I'm spotting the, you know, the common factors and how can I group them together and lump them together so that I have a good spread of things. But I also have what I think is 10 talking points that pretty much cover all of the important things. So the top 10 is meant to be quite comprehensive and is not meant to sort of miss anything out. And those really are the things that I think are the 10 most important things. So I then write that up as the letter. The films are slightly different because we want to focus on things that work visually. It's very difficult to make a film about inflation, you know, a 2-minute film that makes people excited about what's going to happen with inflation. So we do focus more for the films on things that we think will work visually, but are also important themes. And so we don't make the claim that the 5 topics that we cover in the docuseries are the 5 most important topics. Instead, we frame it slightly differently. And we say, here are 5 stories that we think should be on your radar for next year. And there is some overlap. You know, in both cases, the number one topic was the democracy versus autocracy, US, China, this great contrast we're going to be seeing this year between the way the political systems in those 2 countries work. But, you know, in other areas, there is a bit more of a, disparity between what the topics are, because we are, you have different criteria when you're trying to make a film that is out there to inform people, but also to kind of make them say, oh, I hadn't thought of that. And then, of course, they can click from the ends of those films and they can come in and see the full table of contents of all of our predictions about all sorts of things. So it's sort of serving a slightly different purpose, which is to get people thinking about what might these topics be and what might they want to read more about.
So, as you said, you know, at the front of the magazine, you exercise the editor's prerogative and you lay out your top 10 themes of the year. And I note that, and you just noted that, COVID ranked number 2 this year on your list. And we'll get to number 1 shortly. And importantly, you sort of specifically talk about this kind of evolution from the pandemic phase into more of an endemic phase. And I know that it's only January and 2022 has got a long way to go. But having said that, I think we would all acknowledge that Omicron, is, and perhaps it's evolutionarily moving in the right direction. It looks less lethal. It's causing less extreme versions of the disease. Yet the numbers, it's so transmissible that hospital numbers are going up, death numbers are going up, et cetera. In addition to that, we've got a lot of areas of the world that are either under or completely unvaccinated effectively, which will allow new variants to emerge. And China, obviously one of the largest and most important markets in the world, is still pursuing a zero COVID policy. So tell us a little bit about how in that environment, COVID still, I mean, number 2 is still pretty high, but it's not number 1 anymore.
Yeah, I think we can see the light at the end of the tunnel. We know how this ends. This ends with this being an endemic disease. It doesn't end with it being eradicated. We haven't eradicated the flu. We haven't eradicated malaria. Those are both endemic diseases, and they are diseases that can be deadly. But if you live in a rich country and you take sensible precautions like getting vaccinated and you have access to good healthcare, they will not kill you for the most part. I mean, unless you have an existing condition or something like that, you are probably not at mortal risk from those diseases. But they are deadly to people, particularly in the developing world. If you look at malaria, people have talked about, could we have a zero malaria strategy? Could we wipe it out? How much would it cost? It was done with smallpox. It was very difficult. It took a long time, and it would be more difficult with malaria. So we know that the end game is that COVID is going to be always with us. I mean, the flu of 1918 is still with us, right? That's H1N1, I believe. It's one of the common colds. And we've seen this, that, some of the other common colds are coronaviruses. So we know that that's where we end up. The question is, how long does it take and sort of how do we get there and so forth? We know we can get there quicker if you have a large defense against it through vaccination. That really helps. And what we're seeing in Britain at the moment, the Omicron wave here seems to have peaked. We have good vaccine coverage. Relatively speaking, we vaccinated a lot of people very early. We don't have we have a hardcore about 10% of people who are eligible for vaccines who don't seem to want to get vaccinated. But, compared to some other countries, that's not too bad. So I think Omicron does sort of show the way forward, which is a disease that is, yes, more transmissible maybe, but poses less danger to people provided they are protected like that. I think the real question here is what China is going to do. China has a problem, which is that it has really tied up the authority of the government with the zero COVID strategy. It has been extremely effective in the sense that the number of cases and the number of deaths has been incredibly small. Given the size of the country, the size of the population, it is an extraordinary achievement, but it comes at a very high cost, which is that you shut down entire cities when you detect a handful. I mean, there were like 3 or 4 asymptomatic cases in a city last week, and they shut the whole city down and tested everybody, millions of people. And I don't think people in democracies would stand for that. You know, I mean, if we see in democracies, people don't want to wear masks, right? They don't want to be vaccinated. A lot of people don't want to think, don't want to have lockdowns anymore, and so on. So the Chinese government has persuaded everybody that, and of course, it's, you know, in many cases been able to do so by force, that this is the right way to do things, and it doesn't want to change its mind. And the problem is that the Chinese vaccines don't work as effectively as the mRNA-based vaccines that we are lucky enough to have access to in Western countries. And so they have not been able to, you know, build up substantial protection in that way. And Omicron is a lot more transmissible. They don't seem to be suffering from a big Omicron wave in China. They are going through these big lockdowns, enormous lockdowns in places like the city of Xi'an. But ultimately, you can't do a zero COVID strategy forever. Sooner or later, China is going to reopen its borders and people are going to bring COVID into the country. And at that point, you have to be able to deal with outbreaks of it. You have to be able to deal with the disease rather than trying to prevent the spread. So it is a difficult position for China to be in. They're going to try and get their own mRNA vaccine sorted out this year. But at the same time, they have they want to keep the country completely locked down this year, both for the Winter Olympics and also for the Communist Party Congress at the end of the year. So there is a sort of special case there. But if we see that other places that pursued zero COVID, like Australia and New Zealand, are switching, and Taiwan are moving, you know, they've had good vaccine take up and they are moving to a situation where they accept a certain amount of spread. But China is not in that position at all yet.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there would be among some commentators a degree of schadenfreude if the world was sort of starting to emerge and China were to then go into an Omicron, wave. But that in and of itself would have renewed ramifications for the global economy, of course. Now, the other thing is this topic is relevant to one of the films as well, which is hybrid working, because, you know, this is something that's of interest to so many people on this call. As you can see, I'm not in my normal office studio. I'm dialing in today from home. Teneo remains closed due to Omicron until February. So what are you seeing on that front? Because, workers, the whole relationship between employers and employees is changing on a whole host of fronts. But this kind of hybrid working issue is one of them, and it's got some both positive and negative externalities. So what are you finding on that?
Yeah, I think, obviously, people have died and people have become very sick as a result of this. But I think for those of us who come out of the other side of the pandemic, the biggest long-term impact it will have will be on the way that we work. Now, we should point out up front that about 50% of the population, of the working population, can work remotely in most rich countries. So it's not everyone, obviously, you know, car mechanics, hard to do that remotely, people who work on oil platforms, et cetera, et cetera. But for those of us who do work in fields where remote work is possible, you know, we figured out how to do a lot of things remotely. And this enforced experiment where everyone did it at the same time has shown that actually it does have, you know, quite a few benefits. And so there is a surprising degree of consensus that a hybrid outcome where it doesn't mean you go fully remote, but it means you spend some of your time at home, some of the time in the office, is, you know, the way a lot of people are going to be working in the future. And that is a massive shift. It's as big as the shift, you know, from mainly agricultural to mainly factory work to, you know, the rise of big offices and information workers and so on. However, beyond that basic consensus that more of us are going to be working in a hybrid way in the future, there is an enormous amount of scope for disagreement. And I think what we're seeing now, and it's going to take years to work this out, but we're seeing where the sort of fault lines are, where are the sources of disagreement. There are some really basic ones. Managers are much more keen on people going back to the office than workers are. Managers like offices, right? They generally have better offices, and they kind of feel like they can do their jobs, and be more useful and walk around and see what everyone's doing and so forth. And so there are disparities in surveys between what workers want and what managers want. And workers tend to say they want more days at home than managers would like them to have. So we've seen that come to the surface in some companies, like, for example, Apple. Apple had this agreement that people would be spending 2 days at home and 3 days in their big new spaceship headquarters, and there was pushback from quite a lot of the workers there who said, look, if we could work 2 days a week in the office and 3 days at home, then we could afford to live further out, because we would put up with a long commute 2 days a week, but we might not put up with it 3 days a week. And then we could afford to live somewhere less expensive. We could have a better quality of life. And, you know, now people at Apple are prepared to say that in public, because, you know, people at Apple are pretty confident they can get a job somewhere else. But I think that is representative of the sorts of tensions we're seeing. But there are other tensions as well, because that's sort of assuming that all workers have the same preferences, and they don't. And there are some astonishing figures from the US, but also we're seeing similar things in Europe as well. Essentially, so there was an amazing survey that Slack did that found that 3% of black information workers in America wanted to return to the office full time versus 21% of white information workers. And we see this disparity that also women are less keen on returning to the office than men are, because they're more likely to be involved in childcare. So flexibility and remote working and hybrid working has more appeal to them. So this is very dangerous potentially, because if companies allow people to decide whether they go back to the office or not, and whether they spend more time at the office, the danger is that presenteeism, the phenomenon that managers value people more highly if they can see them in person and are more likely to give them opportunities and promotions and pay rises, that could mean that white men do disproportionately well from that, because they are the group that is keenest on going back to the office. And that could mean that companies go backwards on diversity and inclusion. They go backwards on the gender pay gap, and so forth. And so this is a real danger, I think, because at the beginning of the pandemic, there was quite a lot of optimism about the notion of a Zoomocracy, that this was leveling the playing field, that we were all equal in our little Zoom tiles. But in fact, it's now clear that the hybrid workplace of the future will be less fair unless we design it not to be. So I think it's really important that companies think about all of that.
You know, you're talking a lot here about preferences of managers and preferences of workers. I'm wondering also about just the, you know, and I know the magazine is looking at the year ahead, but looking out even further, you know, and I know we're sort of narrowly focusing this conversation on kind of white collar professions. But, you know, even in those professions, there's a we don't think of them as, as sort of where, you know, junior people kind of sit there and learn at the elbow of their seniors. But the reality of it is that you learn your craft from watching your senior people, right? And as a result, you know, you can't get all of that over Zoom. It's what happens between the calls. It's their body language. It's that you learn how to deal in crisis and move your career along. And so, are there long term, you know, sort of, you know, deficiencies that are being created here between those who are willing to go in and sit next to their manager versus those who really just want to sit at home, and that they're not absolutely going to acquire the skills at the same rate?
Yes, that's exactly right. And so that's part of this concern that that there, you know, the fact that some groups of workers are keener to go into the office than others means that they will benefit from that where that's possible. But I think there is also a broader question that, you know, this is working from home is something that older workers who are more established in their careers, have built their professional networks, they can switch to this quite easily. If you're just starting out, you're trying to build your professional network, and you haven't got that opportunity to engage with, you know, bump into people in corridors, talk to people over coffee at the water cooler, you know, whatever, in the kitchen, in the office, those sorts of informal connections are much, much harder to make. And so we're seeing, you know, lots of efforts to try and create networking events, you know, what's the digital equivalent of the water cooler, and so on. But I think that's why there's so much enthusiasm for hybrid, because the idea is that you can bring people together for the things where face-to-face contact is useful and helpful, things like brainstorming, creative work, collaboration, mentoring, those sorts of things. And then you can also have the advantages of people being able to do deep work in an uninterrupted way when they're away from the office. And so it's finding that balance. And I think, you know, we're also seeing big preferences and differences in preferences within industries. So some industries are very relaxed about remote work, like programming, for example. Tech industry is keener on it. You know, people in different functions or in different industries may have different views. There are also regional differences. So this is something that people in Western Europe and North America are keen on. There is a very different attitude to this in Asia. So we see surveys of, you know, of managers around the world. There's much less enthusiasm for remote working and hybrid working in China and Japan than there is in North America. So this is going to take a long time to tease out. And as I say, because you have these differences of preferences in all of these different dimensions, there is a risk of unfairness, and just sort of assuming that it will be okay is dangerous. And companies need to kind of evaluate. This is a chance to kind of relook at their processes. How do we decide who to promote? How do we decide who to hire? How do we manage these things? You know, picking people for to put them on different training tracks and spotting fast risers and so on. How are we ensuring that we're doing that in a fair way? Given that we may not be seeing a full picture of what's happening, and I think this is going to be a difficult thing to work out.
And you are in or sit near London, and I'm here in New York. This also has broader kind of cultural ramifications as well, beyond just any given office, right? In the sense that we can easily see that some of our commercial districts in places like Midtown Manhattan and whatnot are just completely gutted, right? So areas, right now I happen to be in the West Village, it's partially residential, partially commercial, there's a lot of restaurants. Well, it's a pretty vibrant place, even under COVID. But Midtown Manhattan is grim. And, and a lot of establishments, the restaurants, the bars, and the things that are highly dependent on certainly international as well as domestic tourism are continuing to feel the pain. What do you think is going to be the impact on the cities, particularly cities like New York and London, which also are sort of the cultural, center points of our respective countries?
This is a big question. And the difficult thing about it is that you can kind of argue in both directions. And so it's a question of sort of which factors turn out to be more important. But clearly, the emphasis on fancy offices in downtown areas has been reduced. If you look at things, I mean, one interesting proxy for this is if you look at where, say, Starbucks is opening new shops or closing them, what they're saying is that there is less demand for coffee, for sandwich shops, for restaurants and so on in city centres near those commercial districts. But there's more demand in suburbs. So I think we're seeing a sort of spreading out that the centre becomes less important for business. That potentially means that you could reassign some of that real estate for other things. So maybe you end up with more housing in city centres. And what makes a city vibrant is it's a lot of factors. I mean, it's not just. New York's restaurants are what they are because you've got lots of high spending business people nearby. But that's not the only reason. And so. There are quite a lot of different overlapping factors here, and we'll have to see how that shakes out. One of the big questions is, do we need less office space? Because some people are saying that if we're going into the office to meet other people and to collaborate, we may even need more office space. We don't need desks so much. We need, meeting rooms. We need collaboration spaces. So it's not clear that we need fewer square feet. And the other thing is that companies are not ending their leases. They're waiting and seeing. And most leases run for 7 years. So we're not seeing meltdown in the commercial property industry. We're seeing, there's a general consensus that maybe demand in city centres will drop by maybe 20% in the long run, but it will take several years to get to the long run. And I think things could change quite quickly. I think if the pandemic recedes quickly this year, then people will rediscover their appetite for going to cool restaurants and going to the theatre. And, I think cities are amazing machines. They're engines of innovation, and they're incredibly adaptive and incredibly responsive. And people have written off cities many times before and said, well, we're all going to go live in the suburbs. And they've been wrong. So I wouldn't count them out completely. And I think, even if it does turn out that we need fewer offices and we have fewer white collar workers in city centres, cities will find other things to do with that space.
And it is notable, some of the companies that are actually increasing their footprints in places like New York, like Meta and Alphabet.
That's what's interesting there is that the remote working, the requirement to remote work has shown companies like Facebook and Amazon and that they don't need to have everybody in one place. And therefore, when they hire people, and there's lots of smart people they would like to hire in New York, they no longer have to say, by the way, if you come a worker, you have to move to the West Coast. That they can actually get to a talent pool in New York And they've both of those companies have taken big new leases in downtown Manhattan during the pandemic because prices are low, and they're also, you know, optimistic that they can build big branch offices. So again, it's an example of this spreading out, that you don't have to have everybody in that massive building in Palo Alto that that Facebook has, that you can work effectively, and that you can have useful collaboration between people going on in a branch office in New York. And so this is an opportunity for them. So that is why I say I think it's going to take a long time for us to figure out the new dynamics here, because this is as big a shift as the rise of, you know, the office-based work lifestyle was in the first place.
So at the risk of a real record scratch moment here, let's shift gears and go to your number one theme, which is, you know, democracy versus autocracy, echoing what President Biden has been talking about. And that complements actually the number one film in the series as well, which is How China Will Test America's Global Leadership. So, you know, I think obviously this is not just a 2022 issue. This is one of the themes of the century, quite frankly. So give us your take here.
Well, I mean, clearly, it's not just U.S.-China rivalry, although that's a big thing. But the U.S. is sort of, you know, the leader of the free world. It's supposed to, it stands for democracy more broadly. And China offers this alternative model of this is another way you could run things. And China has been making the case very clearly, you know, in the last few months, that it thinks that the way they run things is actually fairer and better outcomes for its citizens. And they've even, some Chinese commentators have even described the Chinese system as a form of democracy. Now, we would not recognize it as a democracy. They're not voting for their leaders, but they're saying there's a distinction that political scientists make between input legitimacy and output legitimacy. And input legitimacy is, did you know, are you in your job because enough people supported you and voted for you? Output legitimacy is, are you doing a good job and delivering what people want? And the you know, the Communist Party of China would say, we are doing that. We are delivering stability. We are delivering growth. You know, we're an innovative country. We're about to finish our space station. We've got world leading companies in many sectors and so on. So they argue that what they're doing is better. And it's particularly easy for them to make their case at the moment. I mean, America is just giving them an open goal, as we would say, in the sense that, you know, the chaos and the dysfunction of American politics, the prospect of a second Donald Trump term, is a gift to the Chinese propagandists, because they can say, look, this shows you that democracy is dangerous. It's completely unpredictable. The whole country has to change its position on things when the president changes. One minute they're fighting climate change, the next minute they're not. One minute they're supporting their foreign allies, the next minute they're not. And, you know, you get this sort of whiplash that that Trump completely changed America's position on a lot of things relative to Barack Obama. And then Biden has changed a lot of them back again. Interestingly, China policy is not one of them. The idea that we have to stand up to China is sort of, you know, everyone agrees on that. It's one of the few things that that Democrats and Republicans agree on. But there are so many other things. And China is saying, how can you deal with a country like this when the system produces such instability? But we're going to see this in particularly sharp focus this year, because towards the end of the year, just as the US midterms are happening, around the same time, we've got the Chinese Communist Party Congress, and Xi Jinping will be confirmed in power for probably at least another 5 years, if not longer. This is supposed to be the year when he would hand over after 10 years as president to someone else. And he's decided he's going to stay where he is. And he seems to have support for that. And he is arguing that predictability, the fact that you haven't got a new person in who's going to change everything and have completely different policies, is an advantage. It allows the country to plan for things like climate change and so on and so on. So expect a lot of that sort of thing from China, saying, look how superior our system is. And look what a mess things are in America, where, you know, you have these elections, but you know, lots of people in the country don't believe that the voting is secure. You get these incredibly unpredictable changes of leadership. This shows you why democracy is broken and you shouldn't trust it. And there is a growing audience around the world for people who, certainly there are autocratic leaders in other countries who are like, this is great. You know, China is making my case for me, why I should stay in power forever, and democracy is bad, and that's a real, you know, a real problem for people who do believe in democracy, because, you know, it's been on the back foot for 10 years, and that doesn't seem to be, well, actually since the financial crisis, the democratic recession has been going on, and you know, there so far is no sign of that changing.
Yeah, it's interesting because typically autocrats, you know, the biggest challenge in an autocratic system oftentimes is the succession. And, you know, we've seen elements of that playing out in Kazakhstan just in the last week. And it appeared that China may actually have figured that out with this regular 10-year rotation from one set of leaders to another. You know, you set up the next generation of leadership at the 5-year mark, et cetera, et cetera. That is now ending. And the question is whether that is going to become a problem.
A weakness, exactly.
In China.
Yeah, no, so, I'm with you.
We'll see. One question, just to digress here for a moment, though, is, and just to go back to The Economist itself, you know, a lot of news organizations are finding it increasingly challenging to report from and on China. And I'm wondering what your experience is there, particularly in an environment where it's also harder to get into the country, et cetera. But also just in this, you know, in this China versus U.S. kind of period, you've gotten this kind of radical transparency in Washington. It's easy to cover from in one sense, while you've got kind of radical opacity in Beijing. And so how do you balance that? But how are you covering China? What are the challenges you're experiencing?
It's a real problem, and not just for us, for all news organizations, because what we hear and what our peer publications hear as well is that readers want to know more about China, the rise of China, and climate change, the two big stories of the 21st century. And this is something that people want to know more about. But just at the point they want to know more about it, it's becoming harder and harder to cover, because it's very difficult to get people into the country at all at the moment. And even before COVID, you know, getting visas for journalists, for foreign journalists, was getting more and more difficult. And, you know, we have had the number of journalists we have based in China has been dwindling because the visas expire, we have to take them out, and we are unable to replace them. So we are in the middle of a review of exactly this. One of my colleagues, the other deputy editor, in fact, is reviewing, you know, how do we deal with this? What do we do? Because there is this inherent conflict between what our readers want us to give them more of and what we're actually able to do. So we are in the process of reviewing all of that and looking at how we're going to deal with it.
So, you know, I know that your number three risk or number three theme is inflation. And I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole of monetary policy here, because we could do an entire call on that. And in fact, we will be focusing on that in future Teneo Insights calls. But it you know, this concept of monetary policy and the central bank control, particularly when we talk about the Fed in an environment where the fiscal authorities are not pulling their weight effectively, what's also happening in our economies, and it's your number six theme, is cryptocurrencies. Crypto grows up is the theme that you put in there. And we're not just talking about the Bitcoins of the world and whatnot, but there's the emerging world of stable coins and, very importantly, central bank digital currencies. And, you know, in a world where, you know, increasingly, you know, one of the risks that's inherent in a digitized world is the trust that we have in everything from financial institutions to, you know, the value of fiat currencies. But certainly then when we get to digital currencies, that is also going to be an increasing risk. It is a way for, you know, China is already testing this out. It's going to be tested at the Olympics, as we know as well. But, you know, as the U.S. continues to increase financial sanctions against a lot of countries, and they're threatening further sanctions against Russia now, countries are increasingly going to be looking for workarounds from the dollar and the SWIFT system. So, you know, central bank digital currency offer that opportunity. So, where do you think we're going to get this year? Obviously, some of these things are speculative assets. Versus mediums of real exchange and value. Where are we going to get this year on this front?
Yeah, so I think in the past couple of years, we've all had to learn about obscure subjects that we didn't, you know, first we were all had to be experts on epidemiology. And then last year, we all had to learn about like how vaccines work and that sort of thing. And I think one of the subjects that, you know, we're all going to find that we've learned a lot more about at the end of this year is these various digital coins and learning the distinction between what is a cryptocurrency on a public blockchain versus what is a stable coin versus what is a central bank digital currency. Because central bank digital currencies, for the most part, they don't use blockchains. I mean, there are ways you can architect them so that they use private blockchains, but they are a digital coin that is not it's not like Bitcoin. You know, our view is that they are the digital coins that are most likely to succeed and become widely used. And they aren't, you know, they are very interesting. They grant central banks superpowers in various ways. And what the Chinese are doing with the digital yuan, or the ECNY as it's called, is extremely interesting. They're sort of the furthest. They've got 140 million people using it now. They've done about $10 billion in transactions last year, and that's going to go up a lot this year. They're experimenting with things at the Olympics, like how do you, I don't know your experience is, but when you go to China, obviously you go to the checkout in a shop and you see the WeChat Pay and the Alipay QR codes, but as foreigners, we can't use either of them because you need to have a bank account, and you know, you can't use these electronic payment systems at all. So I always end up having to use cash in China. One of the things they'll be testing at the Olympics is how you get the digital currency used by foreigners who don't have local bank accounts. But that's a very powerful thing if you can do that too. There's all sorts of stuff they can do with this, though. The Chinese government is looking at sending stimulus payments directly to farmers, for example. You can be sure that the money isn't being creamed off by local officials, but you can also do things like send a stimulus payment to farmers that expires, so the money evaporates after a month. And you know, this is programmable money like that, where you could send a stimulus payment, and you can say the money can only be spent on these things. So you can't send the money to a farmer and then they buy themselves a new car. They have to spend it on seed and fertilizer and, you know, that kind of stuff. But then you can essentially make the money disappear if it's not spent on the thing you want. I mean, this is amazingly interesting. And of course, these central bank digital currencies allow central banks to see what's going on in the economy in real time in ways that they couldn't before. So this is a very, very exciting area. There are drawbacks to this too. I mean, there are kind of concerns about what happens with the disintermediation of retail banks and so on. But I think the idea that sort of people have in their minds that kind of all these digital coins are the same thing, I think we're going to be starting to learn about, and you've kind of got stable coins in the middle, because the digital, you know, CBDCs are very similar to stable coins in a lot of ways. So I think learning about those distinctions, and at the same time, we're going to see much tighter regulation of cryptocurrencies, this big fight going on between the crypto industry in the US and the SEC. Will it be the SEC that regulates them? They don't like Gary Gensler at all because he actually knows his stuff on this subject. So that will be happening at the same time. So I think the thing that we sort of lump, if you're not following this closely, you may lump it all together as one subject. And I think we're going to start seeing the subtleties and the nuances of how this is going to play out starting to become more apparent this year.
And that's not even to mention the fact that it apparently takes about as much energy to mine Bitcoin as it takes to power Argentina.
Yeah, so, exactly. I mean, that's just not sustainable.
Yeah. So I'm aware of the time. There's a whole lot of other things I wanted to talk about. But for those of you who don't know, Tom started at The Economist as a science correspondent. So I promised him that we would get into a little bit of the science here because I know it's near and dear to his heart. And there's a couple of subjects. The first is, you know, is the space race. You know, we saw a lot in the last couple of years. We've seen a lot of the private companies. Although, you know, of the three, it's really SpaceX that has turned it into a you know, sort of industrialized commercial venture. And you know, and we're seeing Elon Musk himself actually get into increasing sort of fights with the Europeans over who's making the rules in space, and even the Chinese got into an argument with him about who's got, you know, about the amount of real estate that he's taking up with his satellite program. And he's his indication is, believe me, there's enough room for all of us up there. Where do you see things going kind of next here on the commercial space front?
Interestingly, this will be probably the year where more people go to space as paying passengers than as government employees for the first time, which is sort of interesting in itself, but it's mainly joyriding for rich people. The suborbital stuff doesn't excite me very much. You know, the Virgin plane, I mean, it's a fancy roller coaster, basically. And the the Blue Origin, you know, it goes straight up, it comes straight down. Similarly, but Blue Origin does plan to build bigger rockets that can go to orbit. What SpaceX is doing is just of a completely different order, because they can build much more powerful rockets that go to orbit. And they've got this big new rocket called Starship, which will fly for the first time in the next few months. And that's even bigger than anything they've built so far. It's the biggest rocket ever made. It's bigger than the Saturn V, and it can launch more to orbit. And you know, that's what is expected to take American astronauts to the moon in the next few years. But it can actually go also. It could go to Mars. It could go. You know, it's a very interesting rocket system. So I think that's the thing that could upstage everything else this year. That rocket will fly, do its first suborbital flight. This year. I mean, they've done a few kind of, you know, landing tests and things so far, but that the first real test of that system will come this year. And I think it will be really interesting to see what that does, because SpaceX has transformed the economics of launching things once already, and this could do it again. And essentially what's happening with the satellites is Musk is trying to build a telecoms business to subsidize his real plan, which is to go to Mars. And people have said that, you know, the first $1 trillion business in space will be a satellite internet business. And he is trying to build that business. And that's what Starlink is. There's, you know, a couple of thousand satellites up there now. He wants to get that to 12 to 25,000 satellites, which is going to make the astronomers freak out even more. And, you know, there's going to be a big argument about space debris and all that sort of thing. But that's what he's trying to do. So the two things are connected. That's what's going to bankroll the base on Mars that he wants to build. And then, of course, you've got the kind of more traditional rivalry between the big powers. So China's going to finish its space station this year. India's sending another robot probe to the moon. You know, there's various experiments going on with anti-satellite weapons. The Russians did a very provocative test just before Christmas. That's the sort of traditional rivalry. But what's interesting is it's now complemented by this private sector rivalry as well.
You know, we can't talk about science, obviously, without talking about climate change. And I'm wondering where you think we're going to get this year. Obviously, last year was dominated by going into COP26, which at the end of the day, you know, when you think about where we need to get in the second half of the century and whatnot, wasn't particularly impressive. I think we go back, you know, it really always goes back to something that President Obama wrote in your own pages, right, which was talking a lot about how the climate change is just too slow moving of a crisis. There's always a near term crisis that presidents and other leaders are going to have to deal with. And you have to really change behaviors here quite dramatically on the part of your electorate. You know, and as a thinker said way back when, you know, it's very difficult to get somebody to believe something when their livelihood really depends on them not believing it. And so we see that in some of the negotiations with the senator from West Virginia as an example. So where do you think what do you think is going to happen this year on that front? And one other thing I wanted you to touch on, and you know, this is a whole other subject, but as we go into the energy transition and we go into, you know, ever increasing electric vehicles and the like, increasingly the inputs into these technologies is going to create a whole new commodity race that's going to rival what we saw in the 20th century for oil and gas and coal, right? It's going to be for lithium, it's going to be for cobalt, it's going to be for nickel, it's going to be for copper, and they come from some of the most unstable places in the world. And you know, we're going to have a whole new geopolitical great game for these metals. So what do you think you're going to see this year?
I don't think we are going to see much progress on climate. I mean, there is the COP27, which is going to be bigger than usual. So normally after the big COPs, you get a few little ones and then they do another big one. The idea is that this one is going to be medium sized, the one in Egypt, and that there's going to be a bit more pressure on national governments to come up with, you know, detailed plans. I mean, one thing we have seen progress on is that the number of countries that have pledged to meet net zero by the middle of the century now covers 90% of the world economy, up from 30% 18 months ago. That's good, but the problem is it's very easy for politicians to promise something is going to happen 20, 30 years from now because they're not going to be around to see it. So, you know, the problem is we've got those big grand promises, but we haven't got the detail. The other thing we've seen, of course, is that in the last few months, the price of energy has shot up because of the rebound from from the COVID recession. And so lots of demand for goods because people can't spend money on services, and that has strained supply chains and has, you know, pushed up demand for energy. And so we have this weird situation that during the COP26 climate conference, Britain was actually turning old coal-fired power stations back on. Because we didn't want to pay the high prices. The price of natural gas had quadrupled. We didn't want to pay that, so we switched back to using coal. And that is directly at odds with meeting our goals for climate change. But weirdly, the solution to both of them is the same. The short-term energy crunch and the long-term challenge of climate change, you meet both of them by investing more in renewable and just generally clean energy infrastructure. And that's what needs to happen. So the world needs to be spending about $5 trillion a year on new energy infrastructure. We're only spending a bit over $2 trillion a year. So we need to be spending more money. And I think that's where, you know, that's the big opportunity, in a sense. That's a massive, massive infrastructure project for the whole world, which is build a new energy infrastructure. And yes, you're right, this does require lots of materials and it is going to have political implications and so on. But essentially, we need to, you know, put our foot down on the gas or the electric car accelerator pedal at any rate, and accelerate investment in those areas, both to meet those short-term energy crunches, but also to deal with the longer-term challenge.
You know, I want to sort of wrap up here by going back to the beginning. You know, and you were talking a lot about how you and your colleagues tee this edition up each year and whatnot. Now, you know, you start in May, you wind up the publication hits everybody in November. You know, what do you worry about when you look at all the subjects that you covered and the calls that you've made and so on? What do you worry, you know, as you look out at 2022 and you see things that have evolved since you went into publication and since the new year has started, you know, looking at just even today, The Economist itself called for Boris Johnson to resign effectively. You know, what are you worried is out there that could happen this year that just wasn't covered in the book this year?
I think some sort of military blow up. We didn't see this whole Ukraine thing coming. And it's hard to see how Putin can back down in a way that saves face there. He's made these impossible demands and there's no way he's going to get what he wants. So I think that's probably a sort of unexpected military flare up like that. And then also, you know, the thing that people have worried about for years is where you get an outbreak, a military conflict that arises because of a misunderstanding or because of, you know, lack of communication. And, you know, people are worried about that sort of thing in the South China Sea or the Strait of Taiwan for a long time. We are reasonably relaxed that China is not going to make a move on Taiwan this year, just because the government is so, you know, obsessed with stability this year. It wants the election, the Olympics to go well, and it wants to minimize any chance of anything derailing the Communist Party Congress. So we think that, you know, they are not going to want to go into a shooting war this year. Who knows what happens after that? So I think the main risk that you know that I look at and think that's going to be the thing that, you know, I wish we paid more attention to, is what Putin is doing in his backyard. We did have a piece on Putin, and we said that his main focus this year was going to be on trying to clamp down on the internet in Russia. That's the kind of biggest source of opposition to him now. He's trying to ban YouTube from Russia and replace it with RuTube, RuTube, because, you know, Navalny, we have seen, he did that amazing documentary. It's, what, 2 hours long about the palace on the Black Sea. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And it's an amazing piece of journalism, but it's also, you know, it's the leader of the opposition in Russia who's now in jail as a result. And so, we focused on, in retrospect, you know, the wrong thing. And maybe we should have been looking more closely at what was happening on the border of Ukraine.
Yeah, it highlights that over the long term, you know, more of the greater risk to Putin is, you know, is internal democratic tendencies and the incursion of sort of Western thinking into his own country than it is NATO encroaching on his borders, quite frankly.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachawara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.